This is Transcripts.
The state of transness in America, the state of blackness in America, the state of sexuality in America, everything that I care about, housing, discrimination, education.
Sharing space, sharing stories, sharing experience. And that is the work. That is the work that I'm so honored to stand here and lift up for you today.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Transcripts. I hope everybody's doing all right. I'm posting this episode a little late. It's actually like almost 10 p.m. here, and I'm recording this while my partner's kid is asleep in the next room. I'm going to try to be a little bit quieter with this episode, at least with my intro, because she's 6 years old and she's been working really hard going to kindergarten on Zoom. So she deserves all that extra rest, which honestly, we all kind of deserve these days. But anyway, first off, I want to start with a quick programming note. In 2 weeks, we're going to be putting out our first non-English language episode, which I am so pumped about. It's a collab with a new Latinx oral history project. It's just like this interview is just going to be so important. And then in 4 weeks, we'll have a brand new in-house produced episode from the Treader Trans Oral History Project, the one that I'm the lead producer on and my friends Merle and Andrea are the hosts of. Our new episode focuses on trans Southerners and their struggles to achieve housing justice, even while home is a fraught and sometimes even traumatizing concept. We have a really powerful set of voices and some genuinely incredible radical trans Southern music. And overall, we're just super stoked to share. We've got really cool people on the team. So be on the lookout for that in 4 weeks. But today, we're bringing you an episode of a show that describes itself as about the joyful, messy, radical magic that happens in the spaces where queerness and food intersect. I actually met Nico Whistler, who's the host of the show, Queer the Table, when they were working on an episode of the podcast Bodies about their experience of being trans and experiencing an eating disorder. And I'll link that episode in the show notes. But they recently reached out to me to share this amazing interview they did with Ian Stewart of the Ochre Project. You'll hear how the Ochre Project got started, what they're doing to keep supporting Black trans people during COVID, and how they're trying to leverage their suddenly much larger platform while still being mindful of their own capacity, which like is just so difficult during these times. Like, little kids are not the only ones who need lots of extra sleep right now, so take a listen.
Meet me in the kitchen. What are we gonna make? What do you crave? Hold our hearts, our histories, share it on. What do you taste? Bring your body, bring your love, bring the ones you're thinking of. Make space and clear the table. And clear the table. And
welcome to Queer the Table. I'm your host, Nico Whistler. This week, I spoke with Ian Field Stewart. Ian is the founder of the Ochre Project, an organization that pays Black trans chefs to go into the homes of other Black trans people and make them a healthy, delicious, and home-cooked meal. Obviously, they've needed to shift their model over the course of the last 6 months, but Ian never took a break. Not only have they been continuing to provide food and care to the community, but they've also stepped into a much more visible role as an activist. This past June, Ian was one of the organizers for and speakers at the Brooklyn Liberation March. To start our conversation, I asked Ian where they got the idea for the Ochre Project.
So the foundational idea behind the Ochre Project when I founded it in December of 2018 was genuinely a reaction to the holiday season. I recognized that I had a privilege of being able to go home for the holidays to a family that had raised me and still supported me as who I was. And so I had been thinking and just sort of, percolating ideas about, like, what might I do to be able to give back to my community and to help alleviate loneliness and people who may feel isolated or disconnected from community or from family. And so my activism, as I've developed the Ochre Project and grown, like, I describe my activism as being about interrogating the exclusivity of luxury, because I think that in making that luxury available to the most marginalized, because I feel like things like therapy, things like a private chef, things like, being able to just to rest, to be at peace, all of that is something that I feel like should be available to the people who are experiencing the highest levels of stress, the highest levels of oppression, the highest levels of, marginality within our society.
I wonder, like, why food was the kind of luxury that you started with, and chefs cooking in people's homes.
Well, I mean, one of the great ironies of the Ochre Project is that I would not consider myself the greatest chef or the greatest cook even. I can, when the moment strikes me and I have some time, I can throw down just like the rest of them. But it is not my instinct to do so. And so I think that in general, for me, I've always valued that someone would choose me, Like whenever people be like, oh, you should come over and I'll cook for you and I'll, just put some food together for you. It's like I just always felt so chosen, so loved, so taken care of. It just was a weight off of my mind. And so I think that for me, I was like, girl, I'd love someone to come and cook for me all the time, saying like, and for that, and for that to be something that I just didn't, that would be a weight off of my mind, not worrying about having to put together food for the day. And for some people, obviously, that is, that isn't a chore. That is like that's something that they love, and that's, why we have the chefs work at the Ochre Project. I think that for me, there's just something about food in general that, like, the best memories that I have with like friends and people are often around food. It's like food is such a communal experience that just to sit down around a table and eat with someone. And I think that's also why, like, it's so important to us that our chefs are Black trans chefs, because it's not just about feeding, bellies, it's about feeding souls. And so when you're in a kitchen, when you bring someone into your home, there's like there's this intimacy to it, obviously not like, an essential intimacy or anything like that, but just like a human intimacy of like saying, of welcoming someone into your home and welcoming them into your kitchen and just allowing them to cook for you. And of course, like conversations are going to arise, between us as Black trans people. And we're going to talk about our shared experiences or talk about, our different experiences, talk about our days, our weeks, our years, our lives. It's like all of those things can happen while someone is cooking for you. It brings me joy to think about Black trans people just gathering around a table and talking to each other and taking that time. And there's kind of a luxury in this like very fast-paced society that tells us we have to constantly be producing, we have to constantly be working. There's a real celebration and a real joy to just taking a moment to breathe and to sit with each other and to just communicate.
I mean, there's so much in there. It's so much like the Ochre Project to me feels so visionary and so ahead, because it's not just about meeting a basic need, which is like we all need to eat. I hear so much in what you're saying about like food as a love language, food as family, and like deeply tied to what you were already talking about, which is like you have this strong biological family to go home through, and kind of finding ways to like offer that family and intimacy to other folks feels so at the core of the way that you speak about the work, and so beyond, we don't want people to be hungry.
And I feel like, just in recognizing that, I appreciate being called visionary, or being called visionary, but also I have to acknowledge that like all of our work is always inspired by other folks, and we're always building off of something brilliant that someone did before us. And I know for me, one of my biggest inspirations around just my personal activism and something that really shifted me was an exhibit I went to called Black Power Naps, created by Nevio Acosta and Fanny Sosa. And Black Power Naps is this sculptural installation that reclaims laziness and idleness as power, particularly for Black people. and specifically for Black people. And it was just this amazing exhibit where we, you know, I walked in and it was just all about like relaxation and slowing down and like all of these plush beds that you could lay down on, or these plush, like, you know, pillows and everything, just like a whole exhibit where you just got to walk around and literally just lay down and sleep and lay. And, you know, at the time I was with a partner and, you know, we were able to like, just like lay together, and we're both, you know, Black, you know, people who love each other. And I feel like that moment for me was so pivotal. Even if it was just an art installation, I feel like it was so pivotal for me as an activist, because it was the reminder that, like, you know, because I think that, you know, as I've been navigating my journey, it's like I found myself, like I have four fire placements in my main chart, so I am very fiery and always ready to kind of go off.
Yeah.
And you know, and I was finding that it's like, you know, oh, like I want to bring that fire to protest. You know, and I would go to protests and I wouldn't always feel safe. And often I would feel like I kind of just wanted to listen and be a part of the experience, but I didn't necessarily want to speak. Right. Of course, the great irony of that being, you know, the Brooklyn Liberation March that happened a couple of months ago.
Oh my God, so like, incredible.
Yeah, so obviously, well, thank you. But like, obviously that kind of shifted. But, you know, it's like, I think that like that exhibit for me was just so pivotal for me as an activist and as a human, as just far as reminding me of like, the power of these things that we are told by a capitalist society are a waste of time, or that prove that we are lesser than, or that we are, you know, or use laziness as a bad word, right?
Right.
Instead of honoring and recognizing that as Black people, and particularly as Black trans people, we are consistently just like traumatized in our daily lives, like just waking up and seeing the number of deaths that we experience and murders that we experience, and the way that people will refuse to see us, even if they have the ability to see us, but choose not to. And all of these various things that we navigate on just a daily basis that have become so normalized that we forget that it's just not normal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that what I hope that the Oka Project does, and what I hope to do within my activism, right, is by providing these luxuries, by providing these moments and saying, hey, I choose you. I choose to, you know, I choose you, and I choose you to center and prioritize and to center your pleasure, your, you know, and pleasure being outside of the realm of just sensuality, but just like how we like centering like your ability to enjoy your life, right?
Right.
Centering your ability to breathe a little easier today, right? My hope is that through doing that, you know, these systems will start to become all the more ridiculous to us, that by highlighting the necessity and the joy that we can cultivate from relaxation, from luxury, from just sitting back, that we can start to highlight how ridiculous it is that we are expected to, like, you know, hustle and grind during a global pandemic.
Right. Yeah, you know, the total, absolutely. I mean, it's a good check for me of like, yeah, prioritizing rest, even to talk about it as what it is, which is a luxury, and as something that feels so far outside of the activism that I often see. And I just am so, so grateful for those reminders of like, late stage capitalism is not the thing.
It's not it. And it's, I think that the reality is that those things, like even seeing like rest as a luxury, it's like, I mean, we are not supposed to be running around working all the time.
Right.
We're supposed to be eating fruit and sleeping. I think that it's like, it's interesting to me because sometimes I feel that like luxury is kind of, you know, and obviously like, you know, luxury, like thinking about like, you know, having like living in a mansion as luxury, right? But thinking of like the kind of luxury of, you know, just like the luxury of being able to take your time, and late stage capitalism has made us so, you know, desensitized to that process. What we are supposed to be doing, particularly Black trans people, after everything we've been through, honey, we're supposed to be taking naps. We're supposed to be fanned with palm leaves. We're supposed to be, you know, like treated, like we're supposed to be eating grapes. We're supposed to be eating mangoes. We're supposed to be just laying back and doing absolutely nothing, because look at what we've been through. Look at what we continue to go through.
Yeah.
And the fact that we continue to organize, the fact that we continue to like return to the streets and move and organize and move and build and fight back and speak up and educate for the 17th time, you know, about our experiences, even though there's literally Google right there, you know, that deserves rest. We deserve rest. We deserve relaxation. We deserve like pampering. We deserve to be treated like, you know, like, yo, you don't have to do anything. We got you.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the joy of the Okra Project provides me with, is that, you know, I get to say, yeah, we have the resources to make that happen for you.
Yeah. So powerful in there. I wonder, like, how do you, because you are in the movement, you kind of mentioned the incredible action at the Brooklyn Museum. And I wonder, how do you square that for yourself? And what are the ways that you find that balance of like, and maybe it's not a balance, but what are the ways that you move through like both being in the streets and the shift to public speaking and like your own rest and pampering and care?
Well, I think that I am still learning, very much so, because I am, you know, I'm definitely a workaholic and have been for a while. And I think that, you know, for me, there's a measure of, you know, there's a measure of what I believe philosophically, and then there's a measure of like what I have to work on as an individual. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, this is why I go to therapy. This is why, you know, I'm still working on myself, right? But I think that part of that for me is, one, you know, there's the logistical things of like, oh, my weekends are now just for me, you know, because this is, you know, the first time that I am now, you know, a salaried girl, and I, you know, have a, you know, and I have a 9-to-5, like as an actress, I've been working pretty steadily and singularly as an actress and a consultant for the past 3 years. So I'm very used to having a schedule that like 1 week I have, you know, I'm doing everything. And then another week I have literally nothing to do. And so I am kind of used to running until I hit the wall, and then I'm like, okay, it's time to rest now, you know? And I just cannot do that. I cannot produce in that same way during a global pandemic, and certainly not when I'm like in a global pandemic and working a 9-to-5 job.
Right.
That also is like not just like any 9-to-5 job. It's not something I can kind of just leave at home. It's something that is always with me and something that means so much to me. So I think that part of that is like, you know, making sure that I just, on my weekends are my weekends, and I do things that feel good for me, that, you know, and that feel good, and also like that support me in healthy and productive ways, you know, and that's just necessary. And I am not perfect at it. I fail all the time, and it's okay to fail. And I have to meet myself where I'm at with that. But, you know, I try to prioritize the people around me who support those failures and support my triumphs. As far as, you know, being more out in the streets than I had originally kind of, it's so funny, you know, before June, I said, oh, you know what, I'm not a protest girl. I had already determined that for myself, and I had been sitting in that for a while. I was like, it's not for me, you know, I get really nervous at them. Like, I just don't always feel protected. I don't feel like I can, like, you know, carve out my own space.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then June came along, and the universe was like, so that was cute. You had a nice little idea there. Get out there and start doing the work. And I was like, okay. You know, because when the call comes, you have to answer it. And when a Black trans woman is given the mic, it's her duty and responsibility to take up as much time as she can. So that's what I've been doing. And hopefully, you know, I try to make sure that it's not just me speaking, but also there are others who are speaking, and I hope that I do a good job of that. I hope that I uplift the other incredible people who are around me, who are constantly teaching and inspiring me. You know, it's work. It's interesting because it's work to not work.
Yeah.
In late stage capitalism, it is a lot of work to not work.
Yeah.
All the time, and to not produce all the time. And so I think that I'm also trying to develop a practice of just asking, like, what is actually serving me? What am I actually deriving joy from? And have I spent enough time, like, thinking about my joy? And, you know, in the middle of a global pandemic, in the middle of, like, you know, the past 8 months for me personally have been a lot, and the past 3 months professionally have been very intense. And so I think that, you know, sometimes it's very difficult to think about my joy. And I have to acknowledge also that sometimes my grief is necessary. My, you know, being able to cry for the people that I've lost in my personal life and being able to cry for the people that we as a community have lost, you know, because at the end of the day, like what none of us really are able to talk about is the fact that like an astronomical number of people have died.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why it's like, you know what, girl, if you don't perform your best today, like maybe that's just not what's important right now. You know, maybe that's just not the thing to think about. Like, because like, I mean, people are dying, Kim, like literally, like, I mean, not to make light of those deaths in that way. And I hope that's not how that came across, but
no,
you know, it's just like girl, sometimes you just got to read the room. And when you read the room, it's like, oh, me stressing out about whether or not, you know, I responded to that email, that can't be the most important thing right now. It just can't be.
Right. It's this piece too of taking your time, of like taking your time to even figure out what you feel. Like, I love that. Like, how is my joy that you said? And and then feel it. You know, like I also think there's this push right now to not feel, to like move beyond feeling and not really reckon with the horror.
Absolutely. I think that like, essentially what I was saying is I'm thinking about the collective trauma that we're all experiencing and how we navigate that. Because I think that sometimes it feels like, oh, you know, we're all kind of trying to have these hushed conversations between each other where we're like, Are you experiencing it too? Are you kind of like, are you like, you know, like losing sense of reality? Are you dissociating all the time? Are you kind of like, because we don't have any way of there's no kind of common language or reference point for us to, particularly in this country, to understand what this is all like, which is in itself a privilege, right? We are confronting our privilege as a nation that we have had to have, you know, like, but it's like, we're kind of all having these like hushed conversations one-on-one where we're like, oh my gosh, are you going through it too? Is it just me? Am I, you know, and we're kind of isolating ourselves within this larger isolation, you know, because we're afraid to reach out. We're afraid to touch. We're afraid to connect. And then there are moments like this where it's like, for whatever reason, this is what we're talking about on the podcast, you know, and this isn't necessarily a conversation that we would have on a podcast, right? Two veritable strangers who are just kind of like reaching each other in this way, talking about, you know, oh, by the way, are you kind of collectively dissociating from like the worldwide trauma we're experiencing and this sort of global dissociation, this global like loneliness that we're all experiencing? Yeah. You know, I think it's just this very odd experience. Like, the world has quite literally changed and we are moving through that change. And you know, and I am tasked and have this very odd relationship to the fact that, you know, like, listen, you know, I never had small ambitions. I was, you know, I wanted to be an actress my whole life. You know, I wanted to be an actress that got to choose the projects that I did. And I wanted to be one of the dolls, one of the girls. Mm-hmm. And so for me, you know, having any level of prominence or notoriety, and I always feel odd talking about it in this way, but, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that that is something that I've prepared myself for, but I've achieved a level of like prominence, or like there's more attention on me and my words. There are people are asking me to speak about things now. And it's because Black trans women are dying and being murdered. And it's because I am a Black trans woman who happens to have stepped forward in the right moment at the right time. And my collective is now an organization that is a part of stepping forward. And so it's a very odd thing, right? This is, I said it before, but being an activist is something that I do because I have to. I stepped forward. I had an opinion, I had ideas, I stepped forward, and thus I was an activist, you know, and here I am today.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something I necessarily like was like, oh, I want to make a career out of being an activist, or I want to, you know, which is like, I'm not interested in that. Like, right. Just straight up, I'm not interested in like, you know, profiting off of, or like making my living off of the fact that, you know, that there is a need for the Okra Project. I would really love for the Okra Project not to exist, because that would mean that we are living in a world where the Okra Project doesn't need to exist. It's a very odd thing. It's like, honey, believe you me, I would love to just be known for, oh, she's a sickening actress and she wears these gowns on the red carpet and that's what she does, you know? And that, like, what joy that would bring me, you know? Because, like, I just get to pretend to be someone else all day. I just get to play make-believe and then people film it and put it on big screens. Honey, that's easy. Like, right. I got that. Like, all I got to do is learn my lines and then, you know, do the necessary acting work that I've been trained to do since I was 4 years old. But how to properly facilitate the experience of taking a breath, how to bridge the gap between, like, the philosophy of rest to the actual lived experience of rest, and how to do so in a way that operates safely and legally within, you know, the realm of this capitalist society while also resisting it.
Yeah.
Child, I don't always know that I'm ready. I don't always know that I'm the best one to do that, you know? But also, like, you know, it would be irresponsible of me to drop the ball, because this is a resource for community and it can drastically change our lived experiences. And so there's that responsibility, you know?
It's you talk about it very practically of, like, there is a need. I stepped up. I wish it wasn't this way. I can imagine an alternate universe in which, like, I'm just collecting my Oscars and that's also a dream. Child, but, like, this is the world we're in
that,
now.
You know, speak that into existence, honey. You know, but yeah, exactly. It's like, there is a world in which I could be, you know, an actress and that's it. You know, when I was 4 years old and all I wanted to be was a princess, you know, there's a world in which I could work for those things. But I also grew up in this world as a young Black girl in Birmingham, Alabama, who was denied her girlhood, and denied her girlhood for no other reason than that I didn't look the way they thought a girl looked.
Right.
You know, and I think that for me is, like, that's the lived reality that brings me to this work and tells me, you know, look, it doesn't matter if this is not, you know, necessarily what you chose, it's what's happening. Mm-hmm. And you have a responsibility to react to it, because you have the opportunity to make sure that another little girl like you, another little Black girl growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, who's maybe being denied her girlhood, has a possibility model front and center that says to her, this is who you can be.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to something that I've heard and thought about, and, like, other conversations that I've had on this show around, and I don't really know how I feel about it yet, but I think about it a lot of, like, those of us that face marginalization, activism is just something that is expected of us. I was having this conversation with a chef who was like, it would be tight to just, like, be able to cook and focus on my work and not focus on the inequities in the food system. But, like, I can't do that as a human. And it's something that's expected of me in a way that, like, it's not a burden that's equally shared. You know, like, white cis chefs are not asked about how do you feel about sexism in kitchens or homophobia in kitchens or whatever it is. You know, women are asked that, and queer people are asked that. Folks that are marginalized don't just get to focus on, like, their own dreams.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of power in that, and it's important work, but it just is a burden that's not equally shared.
Yeah. I mean, it's the fact that, you know, I've never been granted the luxury of just getting to show up as an actress or just as a Black woman in the space.
Right.
That's never been something that was extended to me. I've always had to show up as a Black, trans, queer, lesbian woman. Like, all of my identities come in the room with me. And I am fine with that in many ways, because I see literally nothing wrong with being any of those things. In fact, I'm grateful that I'm all of those things at the same time, because I think that Black trans people are the closest thing to divinity that we have. And also, what I don't enjoy about having to show up in all of those ways in that room with all of those identities forward facing is the fact that I have to try to distill those identities down to easy and comprehensible ideas for the people around me.
Right.
Because that's part of the education that they ask me to do, which is a lot of why, you know, as I have done more press and as I have like been asked to speak more about various things, that I push back, you know. What I don't know where they are now or what, if they actually made the cut, but there have been several interviews where I get asked, you know, what can cis people do? And I continue to respond the same way and say, well, what do you want to do? Because I'm not going to sit here and explain to you why you should care that Black people are dying, like why Black trans people are dying. Mm-hmm. That's not something I'm going to spend my time explaining to you, because if you don't care that a group of people are dying, then there was really nothing that I would, that I can do to convince you of that, because that requires a level of human empathy that I'm not going to spend the time to instill in you.
Right.
Like, anyone who is not Black and trans is not essential to Black trans liberation. Mm-hmm. They can be like, they can be part of the solution of fixing the larger problem that society faces, but I don't have beef with being Black and trans. You do. You fix that problem.
Right.
In the meantime, I'm going to focus on building up resources for my people with my people. I have no need to wait for you to figure things out.
We're going to take a quick break.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back to Queer the Table. Let's pick up with Ian.
I want to talk about like the shift in, we've kind of talked many times about like we are in a global pandemic, nothing is normal, but I think about like the very complicated shift that you had to do from like the core tenet of the Okra Project, which is this beautiful, a Black trans chef is going to come into your home and cook you a meal, and in a moment of huge need that wasn't possible anymore, and you've made that shift. And I wonder if you can talk about first just like what that experience was like for you of realizing like, oh, we have to shift. We can't do this the same way we've been doing it.
Oof, child. So there were a couple attempts that we made. The first one was that we, you know, put together these grocery bags and said, Black trans people come, you know, pick it up. And it was all living in my living room. And we said, mm-hmm. Black trans people, you know, come pick up these grocery bags. And this is kind of in the phase where we were like, oh, we're going to be in quarantine for like 2 weeks. It's going to be a cute little moment, you know? But like, it was during that time when we didn't really know what it was going to be given. So we were like, okay, cool. You know, we need to make sure that people get fed during these, you know, 2 weeks, because we know that like there's going to be shortages. So how can we address that? So we made these, you know, these bags. And we said, all right, so Black trans people come get your food. And we did that for a little bit. And then we had a huge donation be dropped off to us from a truck, and it was like literally filling my living room. And I was like, okay, we got to figure out something else to do. So we found a volunteer with a car who we basically loaded up the back of the car, and we just went door to door. And we had like sort of this traveling grocery store situation. And then as we went on, it just became clear, wait a minute, this is more serious than we thought. And this is not something that we can, you know, and so we had to pull back. We just had to pull everything back. And it's been so hard because, you know, the thing that we're known for, the very thing that we can't really do right now. And so we are actively rounding the corner. You know, if you go on our web and on our Instagram, you'll see that we've like put out a call for Black trans chefs so we can get connected, reconnected to other, to people that we may have lost contact with, as well as to, you know, as well as to meet new folks who we can start working with now that we have a larger platform and an ability to reach those individuals. And so as we're moving through that process, we're going to be figuring out ways to do this safely. And now we've been through quarantine. Unfortunately, there's, you know, it is highly probable that there is going to be a second wave and we will have to go back into like real quarantine, not like cute pretend quarantine. And, you know, and we are actively working at the Oka Project to figure out how to address those measures. I'm not sure if I answered your question. I've been thinking about it.
No, you did. You absolutely did. And I would say too, like, I can kind of hear the, you know, there's grief in it a little bit of like, oh, this is long and we've had to pull back from this core thing. But it also, like, you've also filled in other ways. Like, there's the COVID-19 relief fund that you all have set up and two mental health recovery funds, if I'm getting that right. And so, you know, like, it's the pulling back. I just want to be clear, like, you might be pulling back, but you're still,
you know, I appreciate supporting. That. Yeah. No, we, you're very right. That was, you know, it was tough. And I think also part of the reason that like things really also dipped off, like once we realized that this was, you know, not going to be a temporary thing, was just me as an individual. There was a lot that I was going through and I just couldn't be a leader at that time. You know, I was not able to support the Oka Project in the way that I needed to. And I think that you're right, that there is some grief and there's some guilt around that.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a continuation of what you've been speaking to, which is like, you are real about like the present moment and you're facing it. And I think we'll continue to do that. You're not like, it doesn't sound like you're trying to rush back into quote unquote the way things were before. I am impressed and grateful with the way that you are willing to meet the moment as it is, like the way that you talked about meeting yourself where you're at. You're also like meeting the moment where it is. And certainly there's pain in that, but it's also refreshing of like, you're here. And I'm just really, really grateful for
that
and for your time. This has been so wonderful.
Oh, I appreciate that, Manas. I do.
Things are bleak. I know. But I genuinely feel better knowing that the Oka Project exists. They're providing a model for community care and mutual aid that's going to keep adapting and growing and thriving and resting no matter what. Queer the Table is produced by me, Nico Whistler. Our logo was designed by Natalie Uduwella, and the theme song was written and performed by Denali Gillespie. You can find us and reach out on Instagram at Queer the Table. Queer the Table is powered by Simplecast and is hosted by Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Thanks so much for listening, and please check out the show notes for links to Queer the Table and the Oka Project. We're Transcripts, a project of the Treader Transgender Oral History Project, which is a program of the University of Minnesota Libraries. Keep listening for more from us. We're about to launch our big new episode. Like I said, in 4 weeks, we're going to have virtual community events, new social media accounts, and more. So as always, please rate and review, share us with a friend, and overall just help us grow. We really appreciate it. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks so much. Good night.